It's Monday, June 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, South Korea continues its battle against MERS.
I think the risk of the virus spilling out of Korea is reduced. It is not zero by any means, but it is reduced.
Singapore's foreign minister warns that the U.S. faces a stark choice about the fate of the Trade Promotion Authority, and we meet a musician who's traveling with the Rolling Stones this summer. It's all ahead. South Korea's health ministry has announced more cases of the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, raising the death toll to 19 and the total number of cases to more than 150 since the outbreak was first detected on May 20th. All cases have been traced so far to health facilities. Thousands are being quarantined, and the health crisis forced the closure of schools and businesses and cut by tens of thousands the number of tourists in Asia's fourth largest economy. The outbreak has raised alarms in other Asian countries. China says it's cutting flights to South Korea, stepping up the monitoring of fever and pneumonia cases, and calling on provincial capitals and port cities to identify specific hospitals to handle suspected MERS cases. However, after reviewing the outbreak for a week, experts from the World Health Organization said there's no evidence to suggest the virus is spreading beyond the South Korean healthcare facilities. Malik Pierce, a virologist at the University of Hong Kong, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, South Korean health authorities have, in the last 10 days, greatly enhanced their control measures.
In concordance with that, we do see the number of new cases declining, and together with that, the enhanced quarantine measures, including no-fly lists that people are being put on, much stronger than what was in place at the early stages of the outbreak. So taking all that together, I think the risks of the virus spilling out of Korea is reduced. It is not zero by any means, but it is reduced. Very intensive monitoring in the next 2 weeks is essential to know and to establish whether the current downward momentum will be maintained.
How would you equate this to the 2002-2003 outbreak of the what was called Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, or SARS, which began in China and killed about 800 people?
It is a related virus, but what we are seeing now is what was happening back in November and December 2002, long before anyone knew anything was going on. And this is looking at it in retrospect, right? After SARS had emerged and spread, and when detailed investigations were done, we realized that in November and December 2002, there were clusters of SARS cases occurring in individual cities in the Guangdong province in southern China. These were emerging and disappearing by themselves without necessarily particular control measures. So it was like sort of minor explosions taking place here and there, which were contained and nobody took much notice of it until in February, when one particular cluster did adapt to more efficient human-to-human transmission, and then it came through Hong Kong, and through Hong Kong it spread worldwide. So we haven't come to that stage of that worldwide spread at the moment. We are at the stage of having these clusters of infection. And mind you, Korea is not the only place where such clusters of infection and outbreaks are taking place. I mean, last year we had two quite big clusters of transmission. In fact, each of them bigger than the South Korean outbreak that we are seeing now in Saudi Arabia, one in Jeddah and one in Riyadh. So there are these clusters of MERS transmissions appearing. Up to now, they have been controllable. Because they have been primarily transmitted within hospital settings, and that is crucial because we are not seeing any transmission in the community. Now, as long as it is like that, it is controllable, as it was controlled in Jeddah and in Riyadh. But I think what one cannot take for granted is that at some point that this virus might not change in a way to become more transmissible. Now, it has not done that as far as one can see in South Korea at the moment, but you have to keep in mind that the pot is kind of brewing in the Middle East, because the virus is there in the animal host, which primarily is the camel, and it's jumping from time to time to humans and sometimes causing these large outbreaks.
That's Malik Pieris of the University of Hong Kong. Pieris says the transmission is usually through coughing or sneezing by an infected person, or it's picked up through touching surfaces such as tabletops. He says the virus can remain viable much longer than the influenza virus, up to 24 hours. There is no known vaccine or treatment for MERS. Its fatality rate has reached nearly 41%. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Polshevsky with a look at what's trending today. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, we talked about last week Rachel Dojol. She's this woman who's the NAACP leader in Spokane, Washington. Someone here actually corrected me and said it's Spokane, not Spokane.
Apparently, yeah, Spokane.
But Spokane, Washington, she actually resigned yesterday. We had talked about the story last week, how she said she was African-American, later revealed that she was white. And the hashtag that's trending today is hashtag Ask Rachel. Now, this started out as a way for people to kind of, you know, call her out on this and ask her actual questions about why did you do this. Actress Sherry Shepherd, who's African-American, said, "I wonder what it feels like to finally take off the blackness." That tweet getting retweeted over 200 times. People have now jumped on this hashtag, however, and made it into kind of a joke. They're quizzing Rachel Dojol on different elements of African-American culture, giving her multiple choice questions, asking her to identify song lyrics and things like that. So people are really running with this and using it to make jokes at her expense. Another trending hashtag today, hashtag Youth Day. This is out of South Africa. June 16th, 1976 was the Soweto youth uprising after black and white students in South Africa were given different school curriculums. So this has now become a holiday in South Africa to celebrate youth and youth empowerment. A lot of people taking to social media to offer their hopes for the future, what they think the government should do to appeal to youth and to help bring youth up, and just being very hopeful. So turning that into a hopeful moment for South Africa and a trending topic all around the world today. And I wanted to mention there's a chart that I saw, Newsweek magazine here in the U.S. did, of all of the different presidential candidates. Jeb Bush, the latest among them as of yesterday. And actually some people who aren't running yet but are expected to declare they're running. There are 19 total they have in this list, and they map out what kind of social media they have. Topping the list are Republican Senator Rand Paul and Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders, actually independent senator, excuse me. Each of them have 7 different social media accounts, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. Senator Sanders has a Meerkat account, which allows you to stream video live, as does Senator Paul. Senator Paul has a Snapchat account, which is used by many young people. So it's interesting to look at this chart and see how many of these candidates have social media. Worth noting, of the 19 of them they list here, all 19 have Twitter and Facebook accounts. So there's at least that for that group, even if they only have those.
Yes, yeah, I mean,
these days, absolutely.
Looking back, I remember, because I covered somewhat the Obama campaign in 2008, I was at the New Hampshire primary, and I just happened, the campaign got an email of mine because I attended one event. Well, the rest of the year and for a couple of years after that, I would still get regular emails from the Obama campaign. Well, now even further now with Twitter and Facebook and Instagram.
And there are
Instagram.
People on the campaign that are, their sole job is digital media, digital advertising, and reaching out to people on Facebook. Because it is young people, but it's also, you know, across the board, 1.4 billion Facebook users around the world, and a good chunk of that in the U.S. So certainly a way for the campaigns to get their word out.
Absolutely. Thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Polshevsky. This is The OA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have long wondered why dinosaurs, especially the gigantic plant eaters, avoided the tropical areas near the equator from the onset of the dinosaur era 231 million years ago until about 200 million years ago. The only dinosaurs that lived in the tropics then were a few small meat eaters. A transnational scientific team believes they now know why the big plant-eating dinosaurs stayed away from the tropics. They found that climate in the tropics swung wildly during that time. Wildfires continuously raged throughout periods of extreme drought and intense heat, decimating vegetation that the giant herbivores would have needed to survive. The researchers also found that atmospheric carbon dioxide levels during that period were between 4 to 6 times what they are today. They expressed concern that if CO2 levels continue to rise uncontrollably, similar conditions could redevelop and ecosystems near the equator could again be in jeopardy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear about a jazz saxophonist who's traveling with the Rolling Stones. Singapore's foreign minister, Kay Shanmugam, has warned that in light of last week's congressional setback in granting Presidential Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA, the United States faces a stark choice over its future in the Asia-Pacific region. TPA approval is seen as crucial to eventual agreement on a new Asia Free Trade Accord. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the Singaporean diplomat's warning comes as Republican leaders in the House of Representatives move to delay another vote on TPA to late July.
Speaking Monday to the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies, the foreign minister says it is vital to complete the years-long negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Shanmugam says most of this century's economic growth will come from Asia.
Everyone knows China. But there are other parts of the story. India, Southeast Asia, ASEAN, the 10 countries of ASEAN together, are the seventh largest economy in the world. Something that not a lot of people realize. $2.4 trillion today, but within 5 years, it will be $4 trillion.
He says it is a region in need of infrastructure development and the kinds of fields in which the United States excels, such as energy and information technology, are much in demand. He also says it's a region where history is being rewritten with emerging new institutions, both national and multinational.
In all of this, where is the United States? It's been the guarantor of peace. It's been the guarantor of progress and prosperity up to now. But if you don't do this deal, what are your levers of power? How integrated are you into the Asian economies? Meanwhile, there are a whole series of other trade deals that have happened, will happen, and from which you will be excluded.
He says the United States faces a stark choice. Does it want to be part of the region or does it want to be out of the region? He says if Washington chooses to be out of a region that represents 40% of global trade, its only lever of power will be the Seventh Fleet, a reference to the U.S. naval presence in the region.
Trade is strategy. And you're either in or you're out. And what does it mean for your jobs, for your investments, for your prosperity? I mean, it's very, very serious. And your credibility. Let's be frank about it. The president wants it. Everybody knows this is important and you can't get it through.
The Singaporean diplomat says new chapters in Asia Pacific are being written every day and the world will not wait, even for the United States. Singapore analyst Michael Barr of Australia's Flinders University School of International Studies says the perception of political gridlock and rising economic nationalism in Washington concerns America's traditional Asian allies. He says they would be reluctant to reach agreement on TPP without fast-track authority because it means Congress could further amend the pact.
Singaporeans in particular, it's not just them, are very concerned with managing the rise of China. And Singapore knows that they have extremely limited capacity to do anything themselves about managing the rise of China. All they can do is manage their own response to it. And they really look to the Americans.
Barr says they are concerned about losing faith in America. He says the real worry in Asia is the Americans will show themselves incapable of doing anything effective, even something minimal like signing a free trade agreement. U.S. House Republican leaders have indicated they need more time to build congressional support for Trade Promotion Authority, which is tied to job retraining funding, referred to as Trade Adjustment Assistance, that was soundly defeated on Friday. A move is underway to push the TPA vote back from Tuesday to July 30th. White House spokesman Josh Earnest acknowledged Monday the longer the process plays out, the harder it will be to build bipartisan support.
So the fact is, we believe that we have some momentum. Just in the last several weeks, we've seen both TPA and TAA passed with bipartisan support in the Senate. We saw the Senate do something that many people thought was not possible, which is actually build a legitimate bipartisan majority for TPA in the House. That's good news, and we want to try to build on that momentum to complete what the president believes is necessary to negotiating an agreement that clearly is in the best interest of the economy and in the best interest of American middle-class workers.
Complicating Mr. Obama's efforts to gain fast-track authority is opposition from two key Democratic allies, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and likely Democratic 2016 presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, who Sunday called on the president to listen to and work with his congressional allies. Writing in Monday's USA Today newspaper, Pelosi called for a new paradigm on global trade that gives voice to representatives of the public as well as private and nonprofit organizations. She says workers need more leverage as well as greater transparency and accountability in trade pacts to protect wages, the planet, and security. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
David Byrd and Eric Felton join us to talk about a musician traveling with the Rolling Stones this summer.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Now, David Byrd and Eric Felton join us to talk about a musician who's traveling with the Rolling Stones this summer.
One of the hot concert tickets this year in the United States is the Zip Code Tour by the Rolling Stones. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Ron Wood, and Charlie Watts are rocking stadiums all over the United States. One person you have heard but might not know his name is saxophonist Tim Rees. Eric Felton joins me in the studio to talk about Tim's career and his influence on some very powerful names in rock and roll. Eric, welcome.
Welcome, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm good. Now, obviously, when people go to see a Stones show, they go to see the Stones. But this guy, Tim Rees, has got some mad saxophone skills. And he's also collaborated, I think you told me, with Charlie Watts, the drummer from the Stones, on some jazz pieces, too, right?
Yes, Tim Rees is this fabulous jazz saxophonist who has also made a name for himself in the pop world as a sideman, playing with some of the great pop bands. He's played with Lyle Lovett, played with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and he's toured now for well over a decade with the Rolling Stones as a saxophone player and also plays keyboards, including Hammond B3 organ for the Stones when they're on tour. But the great thing about having a jazz player as part of your band is you may be doing big stadium tour, and the Stones this week were in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and they were on a Wednesday night doing their big stadium tour, and Tim Rees on Tuesday night, the night before, had booked himself a little date at the Dakota, which is a little jazz club in Minneapolis, and so he's playing some Rolling Stones songs there, and who should be at the club, at the bar, and come and sit in with the band but Charlie Watts, the drummer of the Rolling Stones, and then a couple of the other sidemen from the Stones. So in a way, you got a little taste of the big stadium concert at a little jazz club the night before the stadium concert, and I'm going to be interested to see if this happens more often throughout the rest of this tour. If you're in a city where the Stones are coming to play, you might be on a lookout for what's happening at the jazz clubs around the time.
Now, he also has covered some Stones tunes as well, right? He's got his own recordings of some of their hits like Satisfaction and Honky Tonk Women and some of the others, right?
Yeah, he's done two records, the first called The Rolling Stone Project and then the second called Stones World, The Rolling Stones Project 2. The first of those came out in 2005, the second one in 2008, and he's put out a bunch of jazz records, Tim Reese has, but the Rolling Stones project records were all Stones music that he then gave jazz interpretations to, and he's managed to get some of the best artists in the world of jazz to be part of those recordings, as well as the Rolling Stones themselves. So he managed on those records to mix in Keith Richards, Ron Wood, Charlie Watts, with Nora Jones, John Scofield, Bill Frisell, great, great jazz musicians, and the results are really remarkable.
Now, are we gonna see him on Beyond Category, maybe? We're going to try to get him on your show?
I hope so. I hope if he comes through Washington, D.C., we'll see if we can get him to do the show.
All right. Thanks a lot, Eric. Eric is the host of VOA's Beyond Category. You can see that on our website, www.voanews.com. And Eric, do you have a Twitter handle where people can reach you?
We have the Twitter VOA Music handle where we hope people will come and keep up with what we're doing.
So that's at VOA Music?
Yes.
All right. Thanks a lot, Eric. We'll see you next time.
And that is the music of Tim Reese, who is traveling with the Rolling Stones this summer. What an assignment. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The question is not whether the Earth's climate is changing, but how are we going to adjust to the effects of climate change? Climate change poses a threat to every country on Earth, and we all need to do what we can to take advantage of the small window of opportunity we still have to stave off its worst, most disastrous impacts, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry in a recent statement. But even as we take unprecedented steps to mitigate the climate threat, we also have to ensure our communities are prepared for the impacts we know are headed our way. Located at the end of the Ganges and Brahmaputra drainage basins, and with much of its area comprised of low-lying coastal plains, Bangladesh has a long history of disastrous flooding. At about 1,000 people per square kilometer, it has the world's highest population density per square kilometer. Moreover, 80% of the country's population depends on agriculture as a source of income. All of these factors combine to make Bangladesh one of the most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. This is expected to worsen as climate change exacerbates extreme weather events, such as monsoon rains and cyclones, and as sea levels rise with the melting of the ice caps. Some experts estimate that Bangladesh could lose 2 to 3% of GDP growth due to the effects of climate change. Bangladesh must prepare for the changes, but as a developing country with about half of its population living in poverty, it is finding the going difficult. That is why Bangladesh is one of the three countries, along with Colombia and Ethiopia, targeted for climate readiness assistance in the first phase of President Barack Obama's new Climate Services for Resilient Development initiative. This international public-private partnership will work with developing nations to help them boost their own climate resilience by providing them with science relevant to their situation, information, useful tools, and training. The initiative will concentrate on adaptation to changing conditions. And as the program matures, more countries will be invited to participate. When it comes to confronting climate change, no country should be forced to go it alone, because no country can possibly address this threat alone, said Secretary of State Kerry. It will require all of us, every country around the world, doing what it can to contribute to the solution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.